You a golf guy?
Golfish.
No. Golfish. Yeah, I was going to say, Tiger Woods for me was like, that's all I ever watched growing up, played golf. So like, seeing that was like, he's back. He's not quite there, but it was like his lowest round in a major, and it's like tied his lowest round ever a major, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Still didn't win. Oh, well. So I thought the funniest thing that I could do to get us right off the bat was I was going through some of our archives on technerd.com.
Yep.
I don't know. Do you remember by chance in like 2013, Seth, or it might have been Melissa Joy Kong, did an interview with you?
I think it was Matt McCormick.
Matt McCormick. Yes, yep. Matt McCormick. So we have I literally pulled it up and reposted it today. How do you turn $10,000 investment into $20 million in sales? And so I figured there's really no better place to start than that, because it's the beginning and it's a small amount of money that you turn into a massive amount of money.
Uh-huh.
And I figured of all the companies out there, whether they're a tech company trying to, you know, disrupt anything, or they're a services company or whatever, what are some of the things that you ultimately learned or knew or brought into this from a sales side that helped you scale Rise so quickly? And then we'll get into like Rise and what all that is.
Yeah. I mean, I think the main thing is when you are a startup and you have small amounts of capital, how are you going to grow your business? And from a sales and marketing perspective, I would say you have to have at least one thing, and probably only one thing, that can drive leads at a high volume. You know, so what we did was we actually called web development companies. We actually called competitors that were much larger than us. We convinced them to outsource their digital marketing to Rise, because I didn't have a sales force. I was a sales force. And then when I won something, I actually had to do the work. So every day I made phone calls to different web development companies that were not offering digital marketing as a service, and offered them commission in exchange for the leads.
Yeah.
So that's how I was able to initially grow the business.
It's so funny to me because, like, I'm sure that almost every person who runs a company, it doesn't really matter what you sell or do or produce, can relate to the fact that we have this term sort of now in Chicago, I guess, thankfully, I don't know if it's really thankfully, but sort of overcapitalizing.
Uh-huh.
So like prior to, like from my experience, I've never had the luxury of being overcapitalized. It's always been, you've got this tiny amount of money on a string. You've got to figure out how to get from A to B and keep things going. And I think that I learned how to stretch dollars better and make more efficient decisions because of that. And now you're starting to see people with so much funding that they're like hiring positions just to create a position. Like, they don't even need the position. From your standpoint, when you got started, clearly that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
So how did you, I guess, build the force around it, if that makes any sense? Like, how did you build the workforce around the way you're operating? Because one thing that I noticed from our business is I can lance, like, I've always had this idea that, like, I can sell anything. Yeah. So if I can run out down the field and find 5 or 10 perfect clients for us, I could sell them on what we will be, not what we are today. And then I could quickly build the assembly line as we go. And of course, there's lots of risk in that, but I've always been decent at that. What I have struggled to do as a person in the community is teach other people how to do that. I don't know what to tell you. Like, if you start to scale quickly, how do you build that force? You know, you go from $10,000 to $20 million.
Yep.
Like, that's a lot of business.
So I'll give a couple of different answers to that. So the first is, when I first started the business, I used to run a lot of marathons. And when you do marathon training, it's an 18-week training program. And the first long run you do is 6 miles. Then you go 7 the next week, then down to 5, then 9, then 10, then 7. And I started to think about the way I wanted to run my business was in a similar structure, but rather than weeks, it would be years, and rather than miles, it would be dollars.
Yep.
And so the idea was that at a 20-year time horizon. And so the idea was, what incremental investments do I need to make every single year to put up a big growth number the following year? And I just kept on going through that avenue. And so the first is, I had a long-term horizon, which oftentimes is very different than when you choose to go raise money.
Yeah.
So I can make small incremental investments. The other thing that was really important in the earlier days, and still is really important, is I had this philosophy that nothing is more important than your direct report. And we could not afford to make any hiring mistakes.
Yeah.
In fact, in 2006, we let go of 50% of the people we hired. And the reason why is I had this crazy mathematical formula for like interviewing people. And I had every question that was graded and I had these answers and I look at the scores and people would do incredibly well. And then they would come to actually do the job and they basically were very charismatic and they communicated really well, but they didn't deliver on what my expectations.
I would have been fired. I would have gotten hired by you, but I would have been fired.
So I don't know about that, but I ended up creating an analytical exam. And to this day, that's on this like fourth version of it, but you are not allowed to interview unless you take this exam. And it has a 22% pass rate. And so what I found was, because what I was really looking for was strong analytical capabilities. That's talking about this force, yeah. Is that, you know, you want to make it so that when you're selling and you're the promise maker, that there's someone behind as the promise keeper and that they're delivering the same or higher level expectation that what was sold. Because
yeah.
Generally, when you sell something, you put your best foot forward. And oftentimes people are disappointed with what they got. And I want to ensure that that wasn't the case. And I need these high analytical minds in order to achieve that.
So we're talking to John Morris, the founder of Rise Interactive. We'll talk a little bit more about what Rise Interactive does now compared to what it did before. But you just what you brought up there, I think, is really a key differentiator to me, at least from successful companies to not so successful companies. There's a line that we've used with a lot of startups when working with them, that before you launch, the day you launch is the last time you can control expectations. From there on out, everything you've put out there is what it is. Yep. If you promise the world and you deliver garbage, that's what it is. So one of the parts that I think the vast majority of early stage companies, and I will say, I would even say repeat founders, it's like really a very few who understand what their business is in terms of other people's perception.
Mm-hmm.
How did you... I guess I would ask like kind of a double-sided question. On one side, how did you come to that determination that you had to control expectation if you were going to be successful? And then two, how do you convey the message to your workforce to say, listen, we don't ever promise something that we absolutely cannot deliver 100% on? How did you realize that that was going to be potentially a big downfall if you could not deliver?
You know, I think it's all about your brand. And you, as you talked about, you know, you could go to talk to 5 to 10 people and you talk about where you want to be. In my business, I never promised what I wanted to be versus what we were today.
Yep.
But, you know, when you're selling marketing solutions, oftentimes, especially in the earlier days, we would develop solutions that we might not have ever done before.
Yep.
But I would have a good vision in my head of how we're going to go execute this, and then we would go execute upon that.
Yes, I would definitely say, like, yeah. From our standpoint, I would never sell to somebody like something that yeah. I literally just made up while we're sitting here. It was always stuff I knew,
how
plus or minus, I knew I was
yeah.
going to get it done. Like, and if I had to pay out of my pocket and lose money on the deal, you were going to get your product.
Yeah.
Like, I may end up losing on it, but I'll figure
and
it
I
out
think
over
that's
time.
That's all about your brand.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, Rise is a premium brand. We stand by our product. We stand by the quality of service. And, you know, we care deeply about our customers. And at the end of the day, you know, if you think whether it's a large organization or a small organization, all businesses are is a group of people doing stuff.
Yeah.
And whether you want to get your client promoted or help the company grow its profits so that the shareholders do well, you know, if you keep that in mind of who are you actually doing this work for, you know, you take pride in that. And so you want to make sure that what you're delivering is actually going to live up to that brand. And then once you start building a brand, because when you first get started, you have no brand.
Yeah.
You know, then your brand starts building equity. You got to maintain that equity and you got to hold to who you are.
I think that's the trap that a lot of people get caught in. A lot of businesses that don't succeed, and maybe even those that manage a way to eke it out, but they are not what you would call premium, are, I always call it canned air. Like, they are so exceptional at getting in front of people in a room and getting in front of the Miller Coorses of the world and
yeah.
the people who spend money and go, we can give you all this.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to delivery time, like, well, that's not our problem. Like,
yeah.
they got the money and
yeah.
they just assume, like, I'm probably only going to get one or two projects with Miller Coors and then I'll use that name to, like,
get the next
leapfrog
one.
To the next one.
Yeah.
And we've run into them, and I won't say the names because you'll know every person I would name yeah. around Chicagoland and in the industry of whether it's marketing. Obviously, for us, it's a lot of sponsorship and media yeah. creation, who literally, I mean, it's in their business plan. They know that they're going to take the cheapest approach. They're going to sell you a product. They're going to offshoot it, you know, to whatever, somewhere overseas. And the product is probably not going to be great. And I, there are numerous businesses that are built on that. And it boggles my mind that people put up with it.
But they only put up for it for a period of time. And to me...
Well, yeah, I mean, I would... I guess I would agree with that, but I mean, I still see... I guess it, it really depends on as a founder who you want to be.
Yeah.
In the end, like, do you want to say, like, scream from the top of Sears Tower? Well, I guess you guys aren't Sears Tower. It's 20 North Wacker's where
one
we were.
South Wacker.
One South Wacker. So yeah. Scream from the top of the building that we are Rise and be proud of having your name signage on the building.
Yeah.
Or do you want to be hiding underneath it collecting some money, but, you know, not so proud?
Yeah.
And I think it's a decision you have to make.
And I would agree. And I think that, you know, personally as a business owner, but also as a digital marketer, you know, I want us to be known at the best for what we do.
Yeah.
And I want to know that we're adding value. Like, at the end of the day, the last thing I personally want is I never want to collect money from anybody if we didn't give them the value that we promised them or more.
Yep. And we're, like, from the Tech Noise Symbol, like, my guys in here, like, we talk about this literally all the time with our sponsor relationships and clients. It always comes down to, I'm willing to take as long as is humanly possibly necessary to close this deal, knowing that you know what you're getting and I know what I'm delivering and we can do it. And I'll wait for checks for 2 years on one client that I literally was trying to get as a client. I just kept wooing them. But it was like, I knew that I wanted to make sure that it was a deal that they were happy with rather than something that was like, yeah, I got you. Like I got them. So why don't we segue with this into a little bit more of what Rise does, what its core product is. And then maybe some input on your side as to, like, what companies should be focused on from a marketing standpoint. What are more important things maybe than others and stuff like that?
Sure. So Rise Interactive is a full-service digital marketing agency. So we have three major divisions. Media, which is paid search, SEO, programmatic advertising, affiliate, social. So really any way that you can allocate your media dollars online.
Yeah.
Then we offer full creative services, your web development services, all of your digital media assets, so your banner ads, email templates, all your social media creative. And then at the heart of both of those services is our analytics group. And what really differentiates us is our vision is to be the leaders in leveraging data to help brands make smarter marketing decisions. And we really focus on two specific areas. How do you allocate your media as intelligently as possible? And how do you ensure that the creative that interacts with that media is as relevant and as meaningful as possible for the individuals that see it? And the analytics group is focused on answering questions around media or answering questions around creative that give us an edge.
So how did this content perform? Why?
Exactly. Or what could we do to improve the conversion rate optimization? Or what's the navigational structure? Should it look like in terms of how we design these things? Or is, you know, basically we're looking to move numbers through creative, or we're looking to move numbers in terms of allocating your media dollars as intelligently as possible.
So what would you say is I know you guys have clients that literally span the entire size and shape of every company, but what is the perfect size company to start an engagement with Rise?
You know, we're generally working with larger organizations. So they generally, from a media perspective, are spending eight figures. So it's, let's just say, 10 million to 50 million is probably the sweet spot of types of clients that we manage. And, you know, they're generally leading brands that you are familiar with.
Yep. So like a Miller Coors.
Exactly. They are not a client.
Yeah, they should be.
Yeah.
They should be.
They should be listening to this.
The third guest who's coming on's wife works for the CMO of Miller Coors. So, I mean, I know you got a busy schedule, but that could actually be
part of my whole sales strategy.
Well, I figured that. Yeah. You're a smart guy. I mean, I figured that there was a reason. So I guess this is a segue because I was not going to go here, but then you said this and it kind of made my mind open up. As a person who is trying to always build a premium brand and offer services and reach, I mean, I think every business owner, at least smart business owner, wants to be working with the best. They want to be creating content and pushing the envelope for the best brands out there, not just because they can afford to pay the most money, but it's also the most, in my opinion, most exciting, impactful stuff. Yeah. How did you get, and whether this is because you had a personal background or whatever it is, how did you get Rise to a point where you're dealing at like eight-figure projects rather than, you know, the average like $7,000 a month, like that's all we got thing?
Well, a couple of things. I'm 14 years into this endeavor. And if you remember this whole marathon strategy about incremental growth, what I would say is I never was able to jump step, like, you know, and go leaps and bounds. I never got that like massive account that was 10x.
Were you trying at any point for that, or was it just?
Yeah, we get invited to pitches all the time.
Yeah.
That could be, you know.
I guess I should have phrased this differently. I assume that you guys are always trying to grow.
Yeah.
But did you ever think to shortcut or take a shortcut to try to Like, was that ever a thing you got caught in?
I wouldn't say it was a shortcut. I would say that I've been invited to pitches where the scale of the opportunity was substantially larger than the scale that my company currently supported.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I remember we were invited to a major hotel chain with an eight-figure budget when we were 10 people that was global in nature.
Yeah.
And we were invited. So we fought to try to win it, and we didn't win it.
Yeah.
You know, so what I would say is, like, our very first customer paid us $50 a month.
Yep.
And then our next customer paid us $100 a month. And then our next one paid us $200 a month. And we kept on doubling it for a while. I wish I could keep on going.
I was going to say, I mean, like, that sounds like a great strategy. Just keep doubling our revenue every time. Yeah.
But, you know, we eventually won a client where we were starting to get into six-figure spends, and we won a client in the seven-figures of spend.
Yep.
And then we got clients that got us into the mid seven-figure spends. And then we got clients in the eight-figure spends. Now we're in clients with the mid eight-figure spends. So it's always been – our infrastructure has always grown a little bit.
Yep.
And then we've always managed to win slightly bigger as opposed to having any of these leaps and bound type stories.
So you hear. Would you have advice for – because, like, I mean, I feel like this is really – I mean, it doesn't happen. You're very lucky if this happens to you at all. So, I mean, it probably isn't speaking to the larger group. But for those of you out there who have had the opportunity, who have a brother-in-law who works for, you know, whatever big company that has the opportunity to pitch for it, would you recommend to a company, like, if in retrospect, had you won that bid for the hotel, do you think that would have been something that would have helped you and would have been that huge, like, shot in the arm, or could it have been the end of Rise because we under-delivered?
I think at the end of the day, you have to be honest in the pitch of what your capabilities are and what you would do if you were to win this business to support it.
So did you – when you guys – I mean, I don't know if you remember the actual pitch, although I suspect you probably do. Did you come into it and say, like everybody else in the room, we can deliver all these things? Or did you go in and say, our strategic advantage with working with Rise is X and we would do this for you?
More the latter. So we're always very honest of what our capabilities are, what we're able to deliver. So – you know, in this case, you need a global infrastructure. We have to be honest that we would have to – if you think that our methodology and our approach to digital marketing is unique enough and is going to get you substantially greater ROI than anyone else out there, well, then you have to understand that you're going to be patient as we build out a global infrastructure and bring that to different markets.
You're a hell of a salesman, John. So, I'm just telling you. It's like – because I think most people come in there and they're like the misconception and maybe – we talked to, Hyman Miller, or whatever the name of the group is, the sales training group. We had him in here and was talking about the fact that the days of the Glengarry, Glen Ross, throw it down their throat style have moved on. And that if you do stuff like that, you're going to end up out in the woodpile because the end of the day is like, it seems like the natural decision for a salesperson is to always sell the biggest picture. But in reality, the winners I have seen just from the people like you have come through the show, and there's now hundreds of them, the winners are the ones who are like, God, I would love to have that deal 2 years from now. Yeah. I would love that opportunity. And they're very honest about it. And it seems like that's your strategy and it's obviously working.
You know, what I would say is you've heard the expression, you know, this person's such a good salesperson, they could sell ice to an Eskimo.
Yes.
Right.
I do the ketchup popsicle white gloves one, but yeah.
Okay. But to me, that actually is a great con man.
Yeah.
Because you really shouldn't be selling ice to an Eskimo. And that's actually why I think salespeople sometimes get a bad rap.
Yeah. I think, with a compliment, by the way.
I know.
Just so we're clear.
I know. But I'm saying, like, what I look at is, like, when you look at someone who is an excellent salesperson, they actually care about the person they're selling to. They're listening to what their needs are, and they come up with a solution that is going to help provide value.
Yep.
And I think that if more people did that, they'd probably find more success in their business. And also, I think salespeople in general would have a greater reputation.
I totally agree. It's funny that you mentioned this. So this is a conversation. I had Mike Rothman from SMS Assist on the show, well, a couple times now. And he didn't coin this phrase, but he uses it so frequently that I'm like just giving it to him.
Yeah.
He refers to everyone. In your case, it applies directly because you're the CEO.
Yeah.
But he refers to them as operators. So he doesn't really care whether it's sales or I do a show, I'm this.
Yeah.
He refers to you as an operator. He's like the best, like you're a fantastic operator, meaning you understand everything that is in the landscape and everything that the people you're competing against or with, however you want to look at it, you understand their needs and how to get it to them. And that's not a con. That's literally, I understand the field at play and I know exactly what pass gets me to the end zone. And what pass scores for you.
Yeah.
And playing the cards exceptionally well. So I totally agree with you. I think the sales thing, I wish that there were – I mean, this is a waste of a wish, yeah. but I wish that there were less people that were slimy about how they did things. I mean, it probably is good for you because you end up getting more business because they don't deliver.
You know, in the long run, you yeah. know, sometimes in the short run, it doesn't work out your way. But if you stay true to who you are, you know, they come back like, you know what, we made a mistake. Yep. We'd actually love to give you guys a try.
So I want to kind of close up a little bit more on the personal note of like who you are as an operator, as a yeah. runner of company. You know, you talked about this has been it's not a startup anymore. It's a long running successful business.
Yeah.
What got you into this field? What was it yeah. that attracted you to, like, did you come into this going, I'm going to create a great distribution channel, great content management with unbelievable analytics, or was that something that you honed over time?
So I'll start with how I got into digital marketing as a starting point. I was 22 years old. I went to Kenyon College. I applied as a senior in college to every major consulting firm. I made it to the final interview of every major consulting firm, and I got rejected by every major consulting firm. So I graduated. I didn't have a job. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I didn't actually know anything about computers. I just was nerdy enough that people thought I knew something about computers.
So, sometimes it's better to be accidentally lucky.
So I was given a briefcase as a graduation present, and I bought the book HTML for Dummies, and I'd walk around with that in my briefcase, and I'm sitting there walking around as a 22-year-old, convincing people to let me develop the ugliest website you've ever seen. Like the typical 1996 high school version of a website is what I was creating.
Like the MS-DOS.
Exactly. And as I was developing these horrific websites, my clients kept on asking me, well, how's my website going to get found? And I didn't know the answer to it. Nobody knew the answer to it. And so I started to research all of the different ways to market websites. And I became an expert in search engine marketing. And so I kind of fell into the industry really due to not being able to get a job.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up in the industry.
So the whole reason that we're all here yeah. is every one of us went to, you know, for grad school at Northwestern was like, yeah. I want to do this. And there just wasn't there's not jobs available.
Uh-huh.
Create your own.
So I think – I believe in earned luck. So
yeah.
I think, as you said, I got lucky in some ways. Then I went to business school at University of Chicago. They have an annual business plan competition. Took second place in the competition, which is where I won the $10,000 to start the business. I actually didn't want to start a business. I actually went to University of Chicago to go into finance. So I wasn't planning on going into marketing. But then when I did well in the competition and I had all these entrepreneurs and venture capitalists and private equity people as the judges thinking I had something here, I was like, well, maybe I should give it a try.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I got the business started.
Did you ever take on investors outside of that, or was it just – I mean, I'm sure down the road for growth, but like in that early stage?
Not until 2016. So it was 100% bootstrap, no debt, simply growing based on the revenue and the profits of the organization.
That's awesome. Very cool. Where do people go to learn more about Rise Interactive, and do you have like blogs or anything that you still write and stuff like that?
Absolutely. I will go to riseinteractive.com.
Okay.
And we do have a blog there, and we update people pretty regularly on the ins and outs of best practices of digital marketing.
Very cool. John, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Absolutely. You can catch this episode and more at technori.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, pretty much everything social at Technori. Or you can follow me at Katoon. Boom, that's a wrap.